From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. A former advisor to the commanding generals in the Iraq War, returning to a Middle East in revolutionary turmoil inside the Arab world tonight on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Emma Skye worked in the Middle East for 20 years. She was made an officer of the Order of the British Empire, OBE, for her service in Iraq. Emma currently senior fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. She was on this show for her last book, The Unraveling, High Hopes and Missed Opportunities in Iraq. Her new book is In a Time of Monsters, Travels Through a Middle East in Revolt, and she joins us at Yale graduation weekend down there. Hi, Emma. How you doing? Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So tell me this. Who in their right mind to get away from things goes to the Middle East to travel by themselves?
Well, someone who loves the Middle East. I think when you're, you know, sitting in the United States, the Middle East looks so dangerous, so fearful.
Yeah.
The only coverage is terrorism and violence. And yet that is only a tiny part of the story. The Middle East is fascinating. There's so many different peoples. There's so much to see and so many different people to meet there.
Book is fascinating, by the way. And the Middle East is not as hospitable to women as you would think?
Well, I find as a woman traveling in the Middle East, I get treated mostly very, very well. I mean, there are always some incidents, but the biggest story is one of tremendous kindness and generosity shown to me. I mean, I travel most of the time on my own, and I'm reliant on people's goodwill and kindness for my safety.
Let's go right to the present first. There's been talk of potential war now with Iran, 120,000 troops maybe brought in, which hasn't worked out well for us in the past. Do you take this threat of war seriously, and how damaging was pulling out of the nuclear deal?
Well, when I heard the news over the last, you know, it's almost 2 weeks, my heart started to race, and I thought, oh my God, is this a repeat again of what happened in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq? Is the threat being exaggerated? Is everything moving us towards conflict? And then I calmed down a bit and sort of breathed slowly and thought, look, we've had over 15 years of conflict in the Middle East. It's clear that President Trump doesn't want, you know, to go to war. Despite his bellicose rhetoric, he's somebody who's been trying to get the troops out of Syria and out of Afghanistan. So I think cooler heads hopefully will reign. Of course, there's the problem of miscalculation. If we hear all this news, well, all this noise in our news, imagine what the Iranians are hearing. And there's a, you know, potential for the Iranians to fear that we're coming to attack them and to do things that look aggressive towards us, and then we respond, and it all escalates. So that's the fear. I mean, the nuclear deal, there was one thing that Iran was doing right over the last few years, and that was complying with the nuclear deal. It's done a lot of other things bad with its use of militias and funding for extremists, but it was actually, according to all the intelligence experts and analysts, it was actually complying with the nuclear deal. So I think it was risky to pull out of that deal.
Okay, now we'll go back to your time there. The Iraq War, we went in for weapons of mass destruction. They weren't there. We went in for regime change to transform to democracy and unintended consequences, right? ISIS, Syrian civil war. How do you look at it looking back?
We should never have invaded Iraq. I mean, as you said, it was based on the theory that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, which he might give to terrorists, and yet that intelligence was proven to be faulty, so we shouldn't have gone in. But nothing that happened in Iraq after 2003 was inevitable. I mean, there really were hopes of a world without Saddam Hussein's, and we missed many opportunities to create that better order. And what we did in 2003 by dismissing the civil servants and all the security officials was collapse the state. And it was in that sort of ungoverned base that, first of all, Al-Qaeda took root in Iraq, and then its successor, the Islamic State. And so without the war, we wouldn't have had all of these unintended consequences, which then led to the refugee crisis into Europe and the rise of populism in the West.
Wow. Let me ask you this. You know, you were right with the commanding generals, Petraeus, McChrystal, brilliant people. And while I know the president's basically designed policy, I have never, ever seen what the definition of win was. Was that ever understood, the mission win?
Well, I mean, at the beginning, you know, first of all, when there was found to be no weapons of mass destruction, then the mission expanded to promoting democracy and Iraq becoming an ally in the war on terror and at peace with itself and at peace with its neighbors. I think when you look at the whole war, it was really only between 2007 and 2009 did we have a realistic mission, which was to bring down the violence, to buy the government of Iraq time and space to move forward with national reconciliation and the delivery of public services. So it was only in that two-year period that we had the right strategy, the right leadership, and the right resources. And that bit we did achieve. Obviously, it all fell apart afterwards because Iraqi politics poisoned everything, particularly the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who stayed in power after losing the election in 2010. And it was his policies, very sectarian, that created the conditions for ISIS to rise up out of the ashes of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and present itself as a defender of the Sunnis against the Iranian-backed sectarian regime of Maliki.
I look at this and I end up, is the Middle East insoluble? I remember Daniel Patrick Moynihan in the 60s had this thing about race relations, saying there was needed to be a time of benign neglect. Bush seemed to operate out of his gut. Obama seemed to overstudy. Neither seemed to work. Is benign neglect or us reducing our hubris that we can actually change things there? Time to stop all that?
Well, I think we certainly have approached the region with massive hubris, as if it was our playground to experiment with our ideas of how to solve their problems. Now, there are many, many issues in the Middle East, issues which are nothing to do with us. And you can look at sort of an Arab state in crisis. But there are things that we also can do. And so often our involvement has been negative. So we've always looked at the Middle East as some place that we can buy oil and sell weapons to. And even though we speak the language of promoting democracy and human rights, too often we've supported authoritarian regimes and ignored human rights. Now, some people say, look, the region is such a problem, we should leave it alone. But refugees and terrorism isn't contained in the region. So I think we have to be, you know, we have to realize that if we leave it alone, it's not going to leave us alone. So the question is how to engage, how to try and recreate a better balance of power in the region, because the Iraq war changed the balance of power in the region in Iran's favor. And that's what sort of sparked this geopolitical competition between Iran and Saudi, which led to them supporting these extremists in different countries, turning what were local grievances raised up in the Arab Spring into regional proxy wars, and then the massive refugee flow out of the region. So how can we help create a better balance of power? What can we do to try and bring civil wars to an end? How can we engage with the people in the Middle East? There are many millions of wonderful people in the region, young people who want to live their lives. They want to have opportunities. They want to have jobs. There's much potential there.
All right. We have a minute to go in this segment. There's rumors or whatever that the Kushner Middle East peace plan is coming up, and President Trump has taken major actions in Israel already, moving the embassy, the Golan, and the Gaza. What do you think about the prospects for that?
The deal of the century, the ultimate deal. You know, what can I say? At one level, you have to be hopeful. There was this vision of two states for two peoples, and the final status was all about Palestine in the West Bank and Gaza, Israel within its borders, and some land swaps between the 67 lines. The problem, as it was, I think it was the former president, Shimon Peres, said, the good news is there's light at the end of the tunnel. The bad news is there's no tunnel.
We're talking with Emma Skye. We'll be back to look at why the Arab Spring failed and other travels with Emma as soon as we get back. She was an advisor to U.S. generals in the Iraq War. We're talking with Emma Skye. And in your book, in the Syrian Civil War, I think the title is chaptered Assad or Burn the Country. Does the West lack the will to remove a guy that's gassed his own people and forced 3 million folks out of that President Obama let the red line slip? Tell us about the Syrian Civil War. And I think you were in Syria in your book for part of it, right?
Yes, I was. I mean, I was, you know, when the Arab Spring broke out, I was very optimistic that at last something positive was coming to the region. And I was optimistic because the push for change was coming from within and not from external intervention. And so I went to Egypt and Tunisia, but my optimism went down when I got to Syria. Because in Syria, again, you had young people just wanting better government, wanting jobs. And there were some kids down in a town called Dera, which is south of Damascus, that had written on a wall some graffiti, a Shabiuri Diskat Nizam, which was the slogan of the Arab Spring, the people want the fall of the regime. And the local security officials there had arrested them. And while they were in detention, there were rumors that they were, you know, they were abused. They had their fingernails pulled out. And this sparked more and more protests. And instead of Assad dismissing the local security officials or dismissing the governor, he went on the attack. And he accused the protesters of being terrorists. And they weren't. These were young, secular people at the beginning. But he wanted to say, it's me or the terrorists. That was the only way to look at the conflict. And what he did was he released the extremist jihadis that he had in his own jails, knowing that they would go and be active in the opposition. So he was very, very cynical.
Wow.
And I think right at the beginning, when I was there, leaders, including Obama, came out and said, you know, Assad must go. And that created the expectation that the West was going to intervene in the same way as it was doing in Libya at that time. So more and more people mobilized, believing help was coming to remove Assad.
And then you have Putin, mischief.
Well, that happened because Obama, you know, drew a line and said, if chemical weapons are used, then that is a red line. And chemical weapons were used. They were used in Eastern Ghouta in August 2013, and 1,400 people were killed. And yet, after that, Obama didn't respond. Everybody was ready for a military retaliation, and that didn't happen. He grabbed the offer by the Russians to remove Assad's chemicals. And Assad got off scot-free. There was no punishment for using chemicals. And of course, not all the chemicals were removed, and he went on to gas his people. And Putin saw what he interpreted as Obama's lack or his unwillingness to do anything about it. And then you see Putin strutting into the Crimea, knowing that it won't be any response. So Putin is really trying to undermine the West, undermine democracy. I mean, all the bombings that the Russians did in Syria was part of the reason that so many people fled the country into Europe. And Putin then looking, how can he undermine the European Union? He can undermine it by flooding it with refugees. He could undermine it by supporting far-right political parties and all the spreading of fake media.
just the whole thing. I just find it hard to believe that we would allow a guy that gasses his own people to stay in power. I want to move to Saudi Arabia, and they're also better 60 years of tyranny versus 1 year of anarchy. You get that paranoia of losing control. Now, MBS has somebody chopped up in Turkey. Tell us about Saudi and MBS.
Well, Saudi Arabia. I mean, I went to Saudi. It was my first time to Saudi. And it's a very difficult place to understand because nothing is the way it seems. You know, to understand Saudi, you have to also understand its paranoia with Iran. And a lot of this dates back to 1979 with the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which excited or almost electrified people across the whole Middle East, this sense of the politicization of religion. And a lot of what Saudi has done or does is in response to that. So when Saudi felt internally threatened that what Iran was doing was going to inspire Shia groups inside Saudi, it was going to inspire political Islam, Muslim Brotherhood, this led Saudi to shore up its own Wahhabi base and to promulgate Wahhabism beyond its borders. And you also had, you know, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, when both the U.S. and Saudi were funding the Mujahideen fighters to go and fight, well, for Saudi, it was to fight the infidel. For the U.S., it was about pushing back on communism. So all of these things have been going on for a long time. And I think it was only when 9/11 happened and 15 out of the 18 people who conducted the attack were from Saudi Arabia that Americans began to think much more about what sort of religion, what sort of Islam was practiced inside Saudi Arabia. So along comes MBS, you know, the young prince, the reformer, who has this vision of trying to modernize the country and pursue what he refers to as a moderate form of Islam, knowing that that would have, you know, far-ranging effect across the Middle East if you're not promulgating Wahhabism and you're promulgating a much more moderate form. The problem is, though, that this young prince is also a bit erratic, doesn't necessarily understand how the rest of the world operates. And we've got, you know, the positive side, which is that he's a charismatic leader with this forward-looking vision, but the negative side of him not allowing any criticism. So Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist who was horribly, horribly murdered after he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, is one of the outcomes of this.
Seems like no accountability either. Last couple of minutes, the overview. Why did the Arab Spring fail?
I think each country is different, and you have to look at the circumstances there. But in short, it was easy to get lots of different groups to come together against the regime and to say what they didn't want. What was much harder was for these groups to actually think about what they did want, and that after the regime fell, how do you put forward a better alternative that wins support? In a place like Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood was the only organized party, so it did well in the first elections, governed badly, a military coup then replaces it. The hope of the Arab Spring has been Tunisia, where when you look at Tunisia, for years there had been a very secular education which promulgated women's rights. And so in Tunisia, you saw a very active civil society. You saw women in all walks of life, female judges, female activists. In Tunisia, you also had a very small army that had never been politicized and had never been involved in the Arab-Israeli wars. And I think those different ingredients in Tunisia, with politicians who were willing to compromise, with Islamists who came into power and then gave up power. So Tunisia had all the ingredients there. The other countries, the counter-revolution powers, often supported again by the Saudis that you mentioned, and also by the Emirates, pushed back against change.
Coming next, we'll dive deeper into some of these countries in the Middle East. Back with Emma Skye. In a time of monsters, travels through a Middle East in revolt is her new book. And I believe she started out in Egypt, and you were, I think, witness to Tahrir Square. And I was stunned to read 90% of women are subject to genital mutilation, and the degree of anti-Jewish anti-Semitism, given the Camp David Accords and stuff. What was the driver there, and how do you find the people of Egypt in a tough environment, a lot of poverty?
You know, the Egyptian people, again, are very resilient. Egypt was the country that always set the trends in the Arab world for a very, very long time. And people remember that. People always refer to Egypt, Umm ad-Dunya, Egypt, mother of the world. And yet now when you look at Egypt, it's no longer setting trends. It is in a very difficult place. The economy is doing badly. Tourism, of which it relied on, has gone down a lot due to the insecurities there. And it's now under military leadership once more. When you look at President Sisi, he's much more authoritarian than President Mubarak was. So Egypt seems to be going backwards rather than forwards.
President Obama started off his presidency with that speech in Egypt to reach out to the Muslim world. Normally the president would go to Israel first, but did that speech not pan out, or how was it received?
You know, that speech back in, it was June 2009, talking of new beginnings between the Middle East and America. It was an extraordinary speech. It was a speech that recognized there had been wrongs done on both sides, that America had overthrown in a coup the democratically elected government in Iran back in 52-53. And there were reasons for this long mistrust. And Obama was saying, recognize these things, but let's look to the future. And he spoke of new beginnings. He spoke of resolution to the Israel-Palestine conflict. He spoke of help and economic development, all of these things. So it created huge expectations. But at the end of the day, these were beautiful words, but there weren't the policies and the resources put to implementing those words.
Yeah,
and I think that's the tragedy of it all, because people were very hopeful that something different was going to come, and it didn't come.
Look, going back to Tunisia, which you mentioned, that was where the Arab Spring actually started, and you talk about them being more moderate. Are there things from Tunisia that could spread to other countries that might be positive, or is it just so different?
You know, I think it's important to have one country that serves as a role model. So yes, if Tunisia shows the other countries that it's possible, then of course that will inspire people. But Tunisia is very small. It's small population, small homogenous population, and it doesn't necessarily mean that what happens there will then spread. If Egypt, for instance, had been the great success story, then it would have far more influence because of the films and the music that come out of Egypt. But I think Tunisia is important because it shows, hey, it's possible.
Oman was another country that seemed to be a little bit more acceptable to reform.
Oman, yes, but for different reasons from Tunisia. Oman is, you know, a beautiful country. It's a wonderful country to visit. It's very safe. The people are very friendly. And it has a very good leader. So Tunisia has moved to democracy. Oman is under a benevolent sultan, Sultan Qaboos, so a benevolent dictator who really looks out for the welfare of his citizens. So when the Arab Spring protests happened, he received the demands from the protesters, he met with protesters, and he responded. He sacked a police chief, he removed ministers, he made reforms. And that took the wind out of the demonstrations. They felt that they'd achieved something, and so they stopped demonstrating.
Going back to inside Iraq and on the border of Turkey. We'll talk about Turkey, Kurdistan. I didn't realize such an economic boom was going on the way you talk, although I know they have oil. Should Kurdistan become an independent country?
Well, that's the dream of the Kurds. They've dreamt for, 100 years of independence. They were hoping that after World War I, with the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, that they would receive independence, and they were given a pledge that they would, and then that didn't happen. So the Kurds have long held this dream of independence. The problem that they've had is there's no agreement on where their borders should be, and they've also had confusion over their leadership. They've never had a unified leadership. Now, in the fight against ISIS, the Kurds were a key ally to the West on the ground. And inside Iraq, the Kurdish forces took over the territory that ISIS had been controlling. So as they moved to liberate Mosul, they also took over this whole swathe of territory in northern Iraq called the disputed territories, including Kirkuk. And the Kurdish president, Barzani, thought this is a great time to do a referendum on independence, which he did do back in September 2017. But that, the response to that was very harsh. The Iraqi prime minister sent Iraqi forces up to the north, pushed the Kurds back out of that territory, back to the 2003 border, because no Iraqi prime minister can afford to lose Kirkuk and its oil fields. So it really backfired on the Kurds, and there was infighting between the different Kurdish parties. So the economic boom that I referred to in the book, that then came to a halt, and the Kurds have been through a period of real financial difficulty.
Wow. You mentioned ISIS, which the book calls the bastard child of the Iraq War. Is ISIS, has it been defeated? And you talk about, interesting too, is what is the difference between Al-Qaeda and ISIS?
So I think this iteration of ISIS, as in the physical caliphate, has been defeated. You remember back in 2014, ISIS swept across a third of Iraq and across large swathes of Syria. It ended up controlling territory the size of the UK, with 10 million people under its command, under its control. Now that has ended. The anti-ISIS coalition with air power and supporting local militias on the ground has succeeded in destroying the physical caliphate. But what remains are, tens of thousands of people who are in jail. And you can see these very quick trials that are happening of ISIS fighters and people being sentenced to death. But you also hear that it could be relatives of people in ISIS or people just accused of being in ISIS who weren't. And they're not really having fair trials. There are also these isolation camps with an estimated 40,000 women and children. So the ISIS wives, jihadi brides, and some of them are themselves committed fighters there, but others who were just swept along with it. And then the kids. So some of these kids were born off rape. Some of them, the kids of foreign fighters who came and their parents had killed. What happens to them? And if they're just kept in these camps and they've got no hope of being rehabilitated back into society, I think you're growing the next generation of fighters. And nobody wants to deal with this issue. It's a very, very difficult issue. Meanwhile, around the world, you've got different groups that are kind of ISIS franchise that claim allegiance to ISIS. They might not get direct commands from ISIS, but they wave the ISIS flag. So, yes, the current iteration has gone, but what comes next could come out in lots of different forms.
What are the differences with Al-Qaeda?
Well, originally, they have very similar ideologies, but bin Laden, his view was to attack the far enemy in terms of the United States, because it viewed the far enemy, the United States, as supporting the dictators, the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East. So his plan was attack the far enemy, and that will stop them from supporting these regimes. ISIS, its strategy was to really go after the near enemy. So to set up the caliphate immediately, because it was only through controlling territory that they could impose Sharia law, Islamic law. But they imposed it in a way that it was imposed in the, you know, the 7th century during the time of the Prophet Muhammad, rather than adapting it to modern days.
We're back for our final national segment. Are we sleepwalking into World War III? Middle East expert Emma Skye, and nature tends to abhor a vacuum as we try to withdraw a little bit or whatever. Are we sleepwalking into big trouble, and what should we do in the Middle East?
Well, I think, you know, the world is changing, and it's changing rapidly. When you look back to the end of the Cold War, and there was all this hope of a new world order, that it was going to be liberal democracy from here on out. And I think what happened, you know, it's almost America's triumphalism has crashed and burned in the Middle East. And we're seeing the end of Pax Americana. We're seeing the end of that order, that when America was the global hegemon. And I think the Iraq War was the catalyst. The failure to stop the bloodshed in Syria is the evidence of this. And as America, you know, I think what America did in the Middle East harmed its reputation hugely. And the global war on terror became this obsessive hunt for terrorists. There may have been 400 bad guys at the time of 9/11. Our response to 9/11 has collapsed states, has caused the proliferation of jihadis and these armed groups. And we've created many, many more enemies than we took off the battlefield. And while this was going on, it has sapped America's reputation, also its resources. And in the meantime, the East has been rising. And I think now when you look at America pulling back from the Middle East, what that has done is created a vacuum that is being filled by these different actors. So you see Putin strutting around the region. You see China coming in. You see regional powers, whether it's Iran or Saudi. And you see a lot of these non-state actors in terms of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and different militias. Now, the Middle East has just become one of a number of competing spheres of influence. And I think these are the symptoms of us moving from a unipolar world that was controlled by America into this multipolar world that we're starting to see.
Boy, what a description of the architecture of the world. That was brilliant. You talk about the need to reform our institutions. You call Brexit and Trump wrecking balls. What do you mean by reforming institutions?
Well, I think a lot of what we're seeing, when I look at Brexit or Trump or even ISIS, these are symptoms of elite failure, elite arrogance, and the symptoms of failures of governance. We had this period post-Cold War where we could have invested much more in our democracy, much more in our education and in our health, and we didn't. We assumed that capitalism would lead to trickle down, that all boats would rise, that everybody would benefit from this, and they didn't. And you look at elites in the West, that they use their money for outsized political influence. When you had the financial crisis, like 5-6 million people lost their homes in America, but none of the bankers went to jail.
Yep.
And I think this made ordinary people feel that they didn't count, that they didn't matter. And that pushed them towards populist leaders who made everything sound very black and white. And I think we really have to look at our society and understand that it really is important that there is more justice, that these inequalities, the structural barriers that perpetuate inequalities, are addressed.
If I move that structural inequalities to the Middle East for a second here, is the real issue there poverty? Is it Sunni versus Shia? Is it Iran versus Saudis? What's the dynamic?
There are many different dynamics going on. Certainly there are a number of different dynamics. But if you look at the Middle East, you can look at elites. With all that oil wealth, what did they do to build their societies?
Yeah.
And so much of, you know, became kleptocracy. So the elites took the wealth of the country and didn't use that wealth to help the people. And when you look at the Middle East, when you have this such an oil-rich, or so many oil-rich countries, it means that people don't pay taxes, so you don't have this relationship between people and their governments. In America, you see many wealthy people who also don't pay taxes because they get around all the tax laws. So it is a problem of distrust between people and those who govern.
We finish up. Where is the optimism? Where would you be optimistic?
The optimism is in the youth. When you look in the Middle East, you can see young people who are more educated than ever before, who are more connected than ever before. They look at people in the West, they see the sort of lives that others are able to live, and they want to live those lives. People look towards Dubai. They don't look towards Daesh, towards ISIS. They want to live in societies that are governed well and transparently, and that they have economic opportunities.
When are you going back next?
Very soon, I hope.
Really? Any purpose or focus?
I think things are changing so rapidly there. I always want to go and see how people are doing. How are refugees doing in Turkey? Most of the refugees that have been pushed out of their countries, of Iraq and Syria, are actually still in the region. 1 million got to Europe, but many more millions are still in the region. And these countries are having to look at how to provide them with services, how to give them opportunities, how to ensure that they have hope for their future.
I want to, you tell us for 1 minute, you were in the square when Rabin was assassinated?
Yes.
What was that like?
You know, 200,000 people sort of demonstrating and calling for peace, and it was the most amazing atmosphere. It was wonderful. And everybody was singing songs. Rabin was up on stage. And then he went off the stage and we went home. So we didn't know at the time that he'd been shot. It was only on the bus back, as everybody was going back to where they came from, that the news came through.
Oh, wow.
And it was the most devastating thing. I couldn't move for a week. I just sat crying for a week.
Wow.
It was extraordinary. It's like hope has been killed.
Wow. Woo. What happens in Syria?
Syria, you've got half the people of the country displaced from their homes.
Wow.
And 500,000 people killed. And Bashar al-Assad remains in power. And so it's very hard to see how that country can heal and how the circumstances will be set for all the refugees to return. It's going to take a very long time.
And the book is really fascinating, and you get a real ground-level perspective, too, because you spend a lot of time with normal folks and folks that work in or around the government as well. It's Emma Skye, In a Time of Monsters, Travels Through a Middle East in Revolt. It's been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Get our podcast at iTunes. On YouTube, Park City Productions 06604. Thanks to Emma Skye from Yale. Thanks to our national audience for listening. We'll see everybody next Sunday on Business Talk with Jim Campbell.